So the date is the 8th of August 2008. This is Nicola Toombs of Manx National Heritage speaking to Mr Arthur Light about his experiences at HMS St George training base on the Isle of Man during the Second World War. Mr Light, welcome to the Manx Museum. Can just start off, can I ask you when and where you were born, please?
Kenton, Middlesex. 24th of November 1928.
Great. And how did you come to be at HMS St George?
Well, I left school at 14. I was at Colchester Royal Grammar School then. And at that age, I hadn't got any educational qualifications. And my father was serving in the Navy at that time. And I, in fact, took a job in the merchant service. And I spent 18 months at sea from June 1943 until November 44 when I joined the RN. And I actually arrived on the Isle of Man beginning of January, I think it was even the 1st of January 1945.
And how did you arrive on the Isle of Man? What was your mode of transport?
Oh, right. Well, that's when the fun all started. Because the first thing was a train journey from, I think it was Euston, as far as Preston. And when we got to Preston, it was night time, and we were put in a transit camp, which was run by the army. And we spent most of the night trying to retain our blankets because they were full of bed bugs and they were walking. So we were glad to get out of there the following morning. And then I think we went to Heysham to catch a ferry which sailed from Heysham to Douglas. And of course, as it was a war on, we had a destroyer escort to bring us across. And because I was a merchant seaman, I went up to the bar on the ferry to get a beer, and the chap behind the bar said, "We can't serve you if you go to HMS St George." So I politely showed him my merchant service documents and said, "Well, that's who I am, you know, have you been?" And so he agreed to sell me the beer, which I then bought on behalf of the other lads. So we arrived in Douglas sort of quite content, and it wasn't a rough crossing, and quite content to be put into buses to go up to St George. We went into the new entries place, and on arrival you were met by the new entry instructors, and you were going to spend 6 weeks in the new entries where they were going to kit you up and give you all the jabs and all that sort of thing. But that opened my eyes, because the first meal we had there was at tea time, and it was a couple of slices of bread and butter and a piece of cake. And boys who'd come from the training ships, like the Indefatigable, London Nautical School, and those sort of ships, they promptly made their cake into a cake sandwich. And I've never seen people eat. All the time I was there, every boy was making different things into sandwiches, you know. So that was a bit of an eye-opener for me. And we went
in. It's just the noise of your glasses.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so anyway, in the new entry division, we were only there, I think it was for 6 weeks. And that's when I had my first little contretemps with the authorities, because there was an instructor boy in charge of us to do our cleaning tasks in the morning. Because we were called at 5:30, we showered and got cleaned, and if you had time, you had a cup of cocoa. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, you then did an hour's work for cleaning the place. And on this particular morning, this instructor boy said, "You're going to scrub out my cabin." And I said, "Oh, righto." So I go to his cabin, and he then promptly starts to give me a lesson on how to scrub a floor. Well, I've been at sea for 18 months, and I knew a little bit about that. So I told him where to go, and he said, "Right, you're in the divisional officer's report." So I go to the divisional officer's report, and he's the guy who's putting up the charge, you know, disobedience of his orders and all the rest of it. And the divisional officer looked at me, and he said, "So your surname's Light?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Your father, Tim Light?" I said, "Yes, good God." He said, "I serve with him." I said, and the instructor boy was looking so disgusted that there's this man who knew my father, talked to me like a father, and said, "Now, you know, you're in the Navy now, behave yourself, and away you go, and we'll hear no more about it." But it was very fortunate that he didn't have a father, otherwise I'd have had other punishment. But that was my first little brush with the authority, shall
we say. So would you say that was your first impression of the camp?
Well, it was just massive in my eyes. I've never seen anything like it in my life. You know, I mean, cabin. The new entries, we were sort of an add-on to the lower camp, which had, I think there were four different divisions of classes down there, and there were four in the upper camp, but the new entries were beside the lower camp. And at the end of your new entry time, you took an examination, an educational one, not very difficult. But from it, they decided whether you would be an advanced class boy or a general course boy. Well, the pass mark was 100, and I got 101. So I went into an advanced class and went up to upper camp, and the class I was in up there was at Anson 195. And that was on the other side of the road, because the camp was divided by a road that went right through the middle of it. And there was a tunnel underneath, you know, so we didn't have to cross the road. And so then that's when the course started proper, and the course lasted a year. And I think some of the interesting things were probably the way we used to get paid and the amount we got paid. We used to get, I think it was 5 shillings and 3 pence a week, old money. But you didn't get that, you only got 1 shilling, because the 4 shillings and 3 pence were put into a credit account. And then if you needed clothes or some other piece of kit, they would use the money that was in the credit to pay for the other clothing that you needed. And it was quite a saving system, really, which you weren't going to get until you were 18. So that's how much we got paid. And as I was telling some people last night here, that I seem to recall that we could go into Douglas when we had our leave, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But we went into Douglas, and there was a Salvation Army canteen in what is today, I see, a pedestrian precinct. And there we could get egg, chips, slice of bread and butter, and a cup of tea for 4 pence. And just along the road from there, there used to be a cinema. And if you were sort of saving your money, you could pay 4 pence for a cinema ticket, which you had up in the balcony. Or if you felt rich, you could pay 6 pence and sit downstairs. And that left you 4 pence for the rest of your spending money for the week, and then walk back to the camp, of course. But the leave we had, we used to get, once you'd started your proper training, you used to get leave one Saturday, one Sunday, and one Wednesday every fortnight. But your leave was from 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and you had to be back in at 6 o'clock in the evening. And there we were, 15, 16, 17 year olds, being told to be, well, not being told, you had to be there by 6 o'clock. So that was the leave. But I had a friend who, he used to cut hair. And he used to cut hair short enough to pass the inspections, but left your hair much longer than the camp barber, who took it all off. And I used to do my friend's washing, cleaning his Blanco equipment, polishing his brasses, his boots and shoes, all that sort of thing. And we used to go ashore once in the fortnight, and that was the Saturday. And the bus used to come past St George. We used to catch the bus and go as far as the Quarter Bridge Hotel. Go in there, and beer was 8 pence a pint, old money. And we'd drink in there till 5:30, and it was illegal. We shouldn't have been in there anyway, but they never. And then at 5:30, catch the bus to drop us back at the establishment. That was our fortnight run out. Marvellous.
I noticed you call it going ashore.
Yeah,
we
always talk about going ashore.
Yeah. And was that the same in the camps? Was it almost treated like you were
on a ship? That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, always. And the discipline was very strict. I mean, no option about anything, really, you know. For example, when you were what they called laundry clerk, you had to do your own washing, right? And if you didn't know how, they'd soon torture. And we used to have to go and do our washing. That was at 5:30 in the morning. You called at 5:30, go and do your washing. And having done your washing, that was it. And there were drying rooms to get drying while you were at instruction. That's all. But yeah, that's it. Then from 6, as I told you, till 7, we worked. And then from 7 till 8, it was breakfast time. And the Navy, to me, was the only place where they can get a day and a half out of a day. And that was typical in St George, because our programme really was split into three sections. Academic or educational, professional training, which was seamanship, torpedoes, gunnery, that type of thing. And the third element was sport. And it didn't matter if you didn't play sport, you were just told to play sport, and you played sport, whether you liked it or whether you didn't, you played sport. In the summertime, you would go to school, because we used to march from St George to Ballygamine School. And maybe you were at school in the morning, in the summertime. In the afternoon, it would be sport. And after tea, you'd go and do your seamanship, torpedoes or gunnery. If it was winter time, in the summertime, you school in the morning, professional training in the afternoon, or vice versa, and in the evening it would be sport because the daylight was there, right? But in the winter time, back to the morning at school or professional training, afternoon sport, and in the evening the other subjects which you should have done. So you had three half days in that day. The boys' turn in was at 9 o'clock at night. So there were all of us, of the age group I indicated to you, all in bed at 9 o'clock. And you weren't allowed to talk. There used to be four of us, because the holiday camp consists of all these wooden chalets. And in each chalet, there were four of us. And of course, when turn in went 9 o'clock, you're all in your bed. And if anybody talked, the instructors would be walking up and down the lines. And if they heard a discussion going on, they can come in, get you all out of bed, pack your kit, take your kit bag up to the end of the line, as they call it, and double up and down with your kit bag on your back. And after they sort of had sufficient of you, they'd say, right, now go back to bed, and this time be quiet. Yeah. But that was the lifestyle.
Can you, I just want to go back to before you came to the island. Did you know that you were coming to the Isle of Man? Were you told which camp
you
were going
to? Yeah, because I had friends a little bit older than me that joined a year or two before I came here. So I did know a bit about what went on.
So, and you knew you were coming to the Isle of Man, you knew where your training was going to be. So it wasn't a case of arriving at Euston Station and not knowing where
you were going. No.
So back to the camp. Can you describe the camp to me? For example, just a little bit about those chalets and what they were like and what.
Well, the chalets were straightforward, were just a square chalet about, I suppose, 10 by 10 or 12 by 12 feet, yeah. Four single beds, one on each side, and the door, and your kit, and that was it. You weren't allowed to have radios, television wasn't around then, but there was no radios and nothing like that.
Were you allowed any personal items?
Only that is required to keep you clean, basically. You didn't have time to do anything else other than what they gave you to do and what you had to do within your training program. I can't even remember borrowing a library book or anything, not during my training. Because you were up early in the morning, at it all day, and by 9 o'clock you were ready for your bed.
So did you have any mementos of home or any photographs or any letters or anything?
Only in a wallet, yeah. We used to have, by the time I joined, instead of ditty boxes, the Navy were issuing small brown attaché cases, where you kept your personal bits and pieces, like your writing equipment. You did have time to write a letter occasionally, and that sort of thing. And even that could be centred. Well, they were centred. But when it comes to personal items, there was a very strict regime. The reason that they didn't pay us all our money was that gambling is illegal in the Navy. The only legal gambling is what we used to call tombola, which you now call bingo. And the personal side of life, if you had parents who had money, they might try and send you, say, 10 shillings or a pound. And if the regulating staff who sorted out the mail thought there was money in an envelope they'd send for you, you'd have to open the envelope in front of them, and if there was money in it, they would take that money, it would be accredited to your credit account, and they would allow you to keep 2 shillings and sixpence. That was a maximum amount of money any boy was allowed to have. And people used to send tins of blacking and put a half crown piece in the blacking. And they were even onto that move. You know, so it was very difficult to get past or get money through the system. And so, but we were all in the same boat. So, but there were, roughly speaking, 2,000 boys at St George at any one time. And according to the records, there were about 8,000 went through there during the war. But the camp, as I say, was divided into two by the road. And the southern part of the camp was all the administration offices, the dining hall, gymnasium, swimming pool, and what we called the quarter deck, which in fact was the palm court of Cunningham's holiday camp, because you've got the photographs there which show you there's a little fountain there, and it won't be the first time that a pair of Manx skippers were found floating in the fountain, thrown in there by a sailor coming back on board. But what else? Oh yeah, so you're asking about the layout. Well, also within the lower camp, there was a parade ground where all the ceremonial stuff used to take place. In the bottom of there were two air raid shelters. And I'll come back to that because I told one of your friends about that this morning. On the other side, in upper camp, there was the drill shed, which is where you learnt your rifle drill and all that sort of thing. But as well as rifle drill, there were a whole series of guns in the drill shed of different sizes, which were the same as the guns that were at sea in the ships. So as well as field training with rifles and bayonets and all that, we also learnt gun drill. Mm-hmm. And it was far harder than the real thing, but that's another story. Well, unless you want to hear that one. The guns that they had ranged from sort of 12 pounders up to 6 inch was the biggest one. And a shell, that's the actual bullet part, if you like, of a 6-inch gun, weighs 84 pounds. And behind it, we used to have to load with charges of cordite, but we didn't use real cordite because these were drill. Right? But the shell was the correct weight, 84 pounds. And the drill charges were made of timber. And there were four of those on a full charge, which went behind the shell. So the shell was put on the loading tray, hydraulically, and rammed at the breech end of the barrel, followed by four of these wooden chocks. But the barrel of the gun was long enough to take, I think it was four or five shells and the charges. So by the time you're loading the last one, you're pushing five lots of 84 pounds plus 20 wooden make-believe charges. But you couldn't allow, you know, you'd run out of drilling equipment. So a boy was detailed off to stand at the far end of the gun, and when they rammed, he would catch the 84 pounds, bring it back to the other end, ready to load it again. So you always were ramming the whole lot. We were very tiring work, but we were very fit. We were fitter than I've ever been in my life. And yes, and the other thing I always remember, our gunnery instructor was a Cockney chap. And you go through all the rifle and bayonet, all the rifle drill, and the final phase of the training of that is funeral firing exercises. This is where you do the ceremonial, you do a burial funeral. And this Cockney, he said to us, right, before you have a funeral, you've got to have a death. And to have a death, you've got to kill somebody. So instead of doing funeral firing exercises, we will do bayonet drill. So up we went on the field and we carried out bayonet drill. And I have still, to this day, not done a funeral firing exercise. And I dreaded it all through my service career, because as I got more senior, I could have been in charge of these people and having never done it. So yes, that was another little interlude in the gunnery world. But the seamanship was very thorough, very good training. On reflection, I think that when we came out of St George, we could have passed professionally as seamen for a petty officer. But what we didn't have, of course, was the experience necessary to back it up. But finest training ever, I think. And I think if you ask any of my contemporaries or anybody who went to St George, in spite of a harsh regime, and it was, you know, I mean. We used to go down for boat drill to Douglas Harbour. Right, you'd march from the camp down to the harbour, and you prayed that it was high water, because you had to lower the boats by hand from the Davits down to sea level. Then you went out for an hour or two's boat pulling and all the rest of it. And when you came back, you had to hoist the boat again. And of course, if it was low water, you had to hoist it a lot further. And so we used to. And the instructor down there, I'll tell his name, George William Healy, I've never forgotten it. And he was a boats instructor. And he said, before we do anything in these boats, he said, I'll introduce you to tiller soup. A tiller soup, what he really meant was that at the back of a boat, you've got a rudder. And the piece of wood that comes from the rudder head for you to steer by is the tiller. And you can lift it off. And if you misbehaved or didn't do your seamanship drill correctly in the boat, he would unship the tiller and wallop you around the head with it. Today, of course, he'd have been locked up and put away for a few years, but not then, no way. So you didn't misbehave and you didn't do things wrong in a boat. You never forgot. George William Healy. Then you march back and get on with the rest of the day, whatever it might be.
So what sort of punishments were handed out?
We used to call it 8A and 10A. Most of punishment, as the word said, is punishment, not what it is today. What used to happen if you committed, in the eyes of the authorities, a mortal sin, like you were caught smoking or swearing out loud or whatever, you would end up seeing the commander, who would award the punishment. And it might be 7 days, 8A. And 7 days, that means extra work and extra drill. And I've already told you the sort of lifestyle we led. So what would happen, those boys would be up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they'd do their bit of drill and so on and so forth, before the rest of us. And then at lunchtime, instead of having an hour for your lunch, or dinner as we called it then, half of their lunch hour was taken up to an extra drill. And in the evenings, instead of being at instruction, from about 4:30 to 5:30, they did an hour's drill on the parade ground. And the drill, and it's, I've seen it in your archive there, used to be anything from doubling around the parade ground with a rifle. And these are the old Lee Enfield rifles, 18-inch bayonets, and I think together they weighed 10 pounds and 3/4. Huh? And you double round, and you'd march, and then you do the frog march. Now the frog march is, I don't know, you're bent at the knees, and you hold the rifle above your head like that, and you jump up and down on the spot. And as you jump up and down, of course your rifle's getting lower and lower, and along comes the instructor, good, that rifle up, and up you go again. And it is pretty painful. Worse than that, standing to attention and holding the rifle and bayonet at 90 degrees to your body. And again, your arm starts to go down, and along comes in, get it up. And the other arm. And then up here, this one. So it was extra work and extra drill for a man under punishment. If a boy committed a really serious crime, like not coming back from his seasonal leave at the right time by being adrift. And usually they were people who sort of crossed the party line frequently. So a boy seaman would be rated ordinary seaman and awarded prison or detention quarters. And the nearest detention quarters to here was back to Preston, which the army ran. And they didn't want naval people there anyway. So anybody who went there had a hell of a life. And they were in prison maybe for a month, 2 months, 3 months, and then they may be discharged. But yes, it was harsh.
What about pleasurable things? Did you visit
pleasurable
the places
things.
On the island, or did you, when
Not
you had leave, did you ever have leave off
well,
the
we,
island?
Yeah, well, we used to get Easter leave, summer leave, and Christmas leave, which was 2 weeks on each occasion. and that would be taken at your home. And if you didn't have a home, there were accommodation places that would take you, right? And you'd then go off the island, go wherever, and then come back. It was if you didn't come back from those leaves and you were rounded up, then you'd get into prison, no argument. But as far as the island is concerned, in fact, I've seen more of the island in the 2 days I've been here now than I did in the year that I spent here under training, because we used to march from the camp down to the boats. We used to do exercises with the army and things like that. But it was all within the service organisation, you know. And I had very little contact with the people ashore. Very little. I mean, why complicate life, you know what I mean? You're there to be trained, and we're all keen. I mean, I've no doubt in your mind, we were keen to be there. Because, you know, we were very patriotic in those days, and we wanted to have a go. You know? And all we want to do is get trained and get to sea.
So when you went out on your half days off, on your Saturdays,
yeah,
and your Wednesdays,
to the Quarter Bridge Hotel,
did you socialise mainly with other people that were
at St George, yeah,
rather than...
Well, you went ashore with your own kind, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there was very... I mean, they mentioned there were a number of chaps who got married and things eventually to girls from here, but they were very few and far between, very few and far between. Our first run ashore was with the vicar, or the padre, should we call him, yeah? It took us for a walk round Douglas, right? And then to his home for a tea and a bun with his wife, and then back to the camp. That was our first run ashore, first even Douglas. But no, I don't, there wasn't a lot of interrelationship. I think there were a number of wrens at the St George, but most of those were in admin jobs or in the galley and so on. And
there were no wrens being trained there?
No, not being trained here, no. But of course there was Volcari along the road, which was the radar school. So there was quite a few service people here, in fact. There were ATS girls out at Honken Head, I don't remember that. But what else can I tell you? Oh, we used to have ENSA used to come to the island to entertain the troops. That was a theatre group of volunteer theatre stars, you know, artists and whatever else they call them. And they used to hold those in the Villa Marina. And again, we used to march from the camp down to the Villa Marina to go and see these ENSA shows. And some of them were real rubbish, you know. We used to boo them off the stage and all sorts, but you know, we get a blast for doing that. But so there were the ENSA shows once in a while, usually maybe one a term or something like that. You know. What else? Well, a lot of sport, of course. I mean, I think St George held most of the sports trophies on the island because there was very few who could beat us. And that, I mean, I used to play rugby, I used to box, boat sailing and so on. That's part of drill. But I mean, we had hockey team, football team, every sport you could think of was played at St George. So there was no reason for anybody not to, you know. You were not allowed not to play sport, as easy as that. Yeah. And I'm a great believer in it myself. Because if you're mentally fit, physically fit, what more do you want?
So did you have any very good friendships at the camp? Did you strike up friendships that lasted you throughout your career?
Well, I've got friends now who trained at St George with me, yeah. Because at the end of the day, the only people that people like me can really talk to and discuss are people who've been through the same experience. And this is why it's such a shame today, the way the forces are being treated. But that's another story. But, you know, we were pleased to be there. We put our hearts and souls into it. And you were brought up in a very competitive world because, as I said, there was 12 in a class. So within Anson Division, I think there was probably 10 or 12 classes. So there was competition between those individual classes within the division. And then, of course, there was competition between Anson, Rodney, Drake, Frobisher, I can't remember all the others, but you know, against all the other divisions. And then, of course, the ambition was to be in the establishment team. And if you were in the establishment team, you played all the other services on the island. And if you won, you got half a crown pocket money. It's your own money out of the credit, but they had to check half a crown. And towards the end of my time, I became an instructor boy. And as an instructor boy, I had certain privileges. I could wear shoes, which was a privilege to wear shoes. Otherwise, it was boots. Yeah? So I wear shoes and could get 9 o'clock leave. But that's still only three times a fortnight. It would be a short till 9 o'clock. But if you were in a winning sports team, some particular match or whatever it may be, the establishment may well award you half a crown and 9 o'clock short leave. So you could spend your half a crown, I suppose. So there was always sport, always competitive sport, all the year round. And you were brought up in that competitive spirit. And that, of course, in turn, breeds comradeship. And you're getting all the discipline anyway. But with the comradeship, you know, you make bonds, which I proved last a lifetime. Because when you went ashore, if there was ever any trouble, you know, your chums would come to your aid, you know. And if they could see you had any trouble, they'd probably drag you out of it. You know,
so you all looked out for each other?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. That's right.
What did you do after you left the camp when you'd finished at the end of the trip?
I went. I was made an instructor boy because they opened HMS Ganges in January 46. And I went down with five other instructor boys from St George to assist in the setting up of the Ganges again as the conventional boys' training establishment. But by that time, they'd had quite a bit of trouble with the first lot of new entries at Ganges.
Where was that?
At Shotley, near Ipswich. There's two rivers that join, and it's between the two rivers, the Orwell and the Stour. But it's closed down now, it's a disgrace now, it's really terrible down there. But there is a Shotley Museum of the Ganges. And what happened was that these boys were the war had just finished in Europe, because that finished in May in Europe and in the August in Japan. And these boys who joined, of course, were joining the peacetime navy, unlike us who joined a wartime navy. And they were not prepared to accept the sort of rules that we'd lived under. So they sent some of us down there to calm the troubled waters and get it on even give. But I was only there for about 2-3 months. Then I joined HMS Vanguard, the last battleship in the fleet.
And how long were you?
I was only on Vanguard for about a year, and then I went to a sloop called the Actian. Well, after Actian, I went to Armada. From Armada, Indomitable, an aircraft carrier. And by this time I'd progressed through the ranks. By the time I got to Indom, I was what they called a petty officer, RP1. I was a petty officer at the age of 21, which today is unheard of. And I see again in your records that there's a chap there who was made a PO at 20. Because what happened, when the war finished, we had a lot of what we called HOs, who'd only joined for the war, hostility only. And the majority of those were demobbed by 1947. So the Navy still had a fleet, but it didn't have the men to man it. So all the wartime POs and chiefs and leading ads, they all went. So there was a big space. So those of us who were a little bit bright said, right, let's get on the gravy train. So I was a leading seaman at 19, in charge of 33 men on a destroyer's quarterdeck mess. And I mean, most of them were older than me. And today, if I think about it, I don't know how the hell I did the job, but I did. So, then I become a petty officer and work my way through that. And eventually I become what they call a bosun, or a bosun plotting and radar. And from there I became a navigation direction officer, and then retired in 1966. And since then, I ran a few businesses. I sold those in 1990 and retired finally at the age of 60. I've been retired ever since.
So did you enjoy your time in the Navy? Do you back at it.
Yeah, it's a place to, you know, there is a time and a place. But obviously I got married and the children came along, and you know, in those days we used to write to each other, which you folks don't know anything about. We used to write to each other, but not only that, you never knew when you were going to get mail. And you never knew when mail was going to get off the ship. So any crisis that erupted at home, there was no one then writing to you, although they did. But by the time you got it, they'd have to sort it out, you know. But fortunately I married a woman with backbone, so I had no problems there. But some people did.
And have you been back to visit since, apart from this visit?
This is the first time I've come back to Douglas, yes.
The first time back on the island. So have you been up to see the site where the camp was?
I was going to go up there until I had a briefing from one or two people, local people, saying, well, there's a supermarket on one side, there's a garage on the other, and you know, why go back there? It's not, it doesn't mean anything to me.
No, there's not
see
really
a supermarket
a lot
anyway.
Left of
no, that's right. But I was going to tell you about this, these two air raid shelters, weren't I?
Oh, yes, of course, yes, please do.
Right. Now, the King and Queen came over here in July 45 to attend the opening of Tynwald. And in the year that we were in St George, you know, it was 2 weeks when you were what they call part of ship. That means just working around the establishment, doing our jobs and one thing and another. And when we were doing the workship, the man who allocated the work to the boys was the chief bosun's mate. And the chief bosun's mate just sort of said, right, you six for this, you two for that. And when he got to myself and a friend, he said, you two, and you're going to wait outside my store, he said, because I've got a job for you two for the King and Queen of England. So we thought, well, we're very inflated, you know, we're going to do a job for the King and Queen. Anyway, we get down to his store, and a few minutes later he comes out and said, right, a bucket each, a file card, which is a small type of wire brush, a handful of caustic soda, top up the bucket with hot water and come with me. So we go down to these air raid shelters and he unlocks them, the rusty lock and everything else, they've never been used. And he said, now we've got some gratings in here, he said, which the King and Queen will be walking on, and you two are going to scrub them. What he hadn't told us was that the gratings were the gratings out of the hen houses that Cunningham's Holiday Camp, when they had it as a holiday camp, they had their own chicken farm. And when they sort of sewed stuff away, these chicken gratings, unscrubbed or anything else, had just been put in their store. So they'd been there for 4 or 5 years, just and there we were scrubbing. And what really annoyed me was the King and Queen never walked on them anyway, because they covered them with red carpet.
So you're a very important job for the King and Queen.
As if they ever knew anything about it. Yeah. But there you go. Yes, that was one of the jobs we had. But no, you know, the sport, I mean, unbelievable, really. I mean, yeah. You were flat out all the time, you know, no time for anything else, really. I mean, some blokes used to break out at night and come back, you know, hoping not to get caught. But they usually were, so it's a punishment job. But,
Was there much interaction between the camp and the island authorities or the outside island, or was it run completely?
Completely independent, basically. Yeah. The presumably all the sort of fruit and veg and stuff that came in to feed us with was bought on the island, and that sort of trade with the island, I suppose. But we weren't involved in that. That was the administration people, not the trainees side of it at all. But I did get won over the authorities, because when I'd been in the merchant service, they introduced pay as you earn in 1944. And up until then, merchant seamen, if they got a demand from the taxman, they just screwed it up and threw it over the side, because the taxman didn't know whether you were alive or dead, didn't know what ship you were on, anything else. And it was only by chance they might pick up something for me. But when pay as you earn come out, the shipping company stopped the tax at the base. So the captain could only pay you what was left over. And there was a lot of these married men who suddenly found they didn't get any pay at all because they owed so much income tax. And so when I joined the Navy and went down to this big salary of 5 shillings and threepence a week. I'd been in the Navy some weeks and I thought, well, I don't know. I've paid all this tax and I'm only getting this amount of money, so surely they should be sending some of this money back. So I learnt about income tax refunds. So I wrote to them. And of course, when they wrote back to me, it was on His Majesty's Service envelope, and the regulating staff just let that through. What they didn't know, and I didn't till I opened it, was that inside was a cheque for £26, 2 shillings and 10 pence. So I was the camp baron. But to cash that cheque was the problem, because I couldn't go to the pay office or anywhere in the camp. So I thought, well, I'll go to the post office in the Isle of Man, Douglas. But the post office wasn't where it is now. It was in the same street as the Salvation Army canteen. I walked in there with my cheque. I said, can you cash this for me? They said, have you got any means of identification? And we weren't allowed what we call our pay books. We weren't allowed to take our pay books. Of course, all of our clothing was marked. And I said, well, there's my cap. There's my name on there. There's my collar. There's a name on there. There's my jumper. There's my socks. Got my name embroidered. So, oh, all right then. So I got me £26, one in ten, or two in ten, of course. So my friend didn't do any hair cutting for a wee while. And the RPOs and regulate staff never even knew about it. So that was good. That was good. The financial side of it. Oh, the meal times, that used to be you can imagine in the dining hall, the best part of 2,000 boys in the dining hall. And lunch time was their dinner, was the important meal of the day, if you like. And by now, within the organisation, one boy in each class was what they called cook of the mess for a day, and used to change it over every day. And the cook of the mess had to go down to the dining hall 10 minutes before hands to dinner were piped to collect the food from the galley and get it ready for dishing out on the mess deck table. Then at the given signal, the rest of the 2,000 boys came in. You weren't allowed to sit down, you stood up. You had grace, and the officer of the day would grab somebody and say, right, you say grace. And the grace used to be for what we are about to receive. And the uniform chorus from everybody was, thank God. And if you said thank God in an irreverent manner, according to the officer of the day, you'd clear the dining hall. 2,000 boys would be out on the playground, and you'd be out there for 5 or 10 minutes. Of course, when you come back, your food was cold. But you didn't get any fresh food, you ate what was there. That's one part of the ritual. The other ritual, of course, was depending on how big and strong you were. Because as cook of the mess, you were cutting up everything into 12 portions. So your friends got big portions and your enemies got wee ones, didn't they? And you've probably seen or know of the game that you play with paper, scissors and rock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the boys' training, we used to have an expression, I'll bang you for your duff. And that was this, 1, 2, 3, and then do it. So, you know, some days you could have 3 or 4 sweets, other days you could be sort of giving it away. So there's another little thing to play. But the plates we ate off, I think they were supposed to be stainless steel, but they presumably had been used throughout the time St. George had been going. And it was all right if you got the top plate with your food on it. But if you had the second, third, fourth or fifth, from the underside of the top one, there'd be a rust mark in your plate. So when you were eating your mash spuds, as you picked up the mash spuds underneath, there'd be rust. Yes, but you didn't say no. You were hungry, so you ate it.
And what kind of food did you get?
Very stodgy, straightforward, you know, terrible food, really. Soya sausages, I seem to remember, which were triangular, made from soya beans. Tins of tomatoes, but it was just like tomato juice, you know, no actual body of tomato. And the butter was in tins, and in the summertime it had melted, so it was like oil, you know. No, our living conditions were not ideal. we survived.
Okay, well, unless there's anything else that you can remember, then...
I'm just trying to think. I mean, I've told you about the Preston Transit Camp, told you about when I arrived at New Entries, I've told you about the routines, the pay, told you that. Yeah, we were all just itching to complete our course and get to see them, and that was the main thing.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that.
Well, that do you?
Yes.